They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. There are some economic vulnerabilities, shall we say, that this war is making pretty clear. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 8th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, it's not often that the geopolitical, the macroeconomic, and the war news of the day are the same story. Maybe not ever on this program, I don't know. But that has for sure been the case today. The decision by the White House this morning to cut off Russian energy imports. About those imports, by the way, a couple of things you need to know, just because the numbers are getting bandied about pretty freely out there. As of last year, and these are preliminary numbers from the U.S. Department of Energy, as of last year, about 3% of American crude oil imports came from Russia. That is 3% of straight up crude oil from Russia. You add in petroleum distillates, it's about 8% Russian all in. So not huge, but not nothing. Which is perhaps why the president took pains to say this morning.
I'm going to do everything I can to minimize Putin's price hike here at home.
Stand by the way, for that Putin price hike phrase to be in campaign ads this fall. But the catch with it, of course, is that the president can't. No president can really control oil prices in the short term. Sure, drill more. But I was slacking with our energy guy, Andy Euler, this morning. His sources tell him from a standing start, even for producers with existing permits, it takes 6 to 9 months to get oil out of the ground. And that's if they can even find crews for the rigs. I believe we have talked a time or two about the labor market, right? So all of that considered, now what? Crude's at $130 a barrel, give or take. Gas is $4.17 for a national average, not inflation adjusted. That's important to say. But you don't have to have too long a memory to know that in the 1970s, the early 1990s, and even in 2008, big run-ups in energy prices led almost directly to recessions. That was then, though. This, in a pandemic and with a war on, this is now. So Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us going.
It does seem like every time there's a big shock to the oil market, the U.S. economy faceplants.
There's a remarkable correlation over history of recessions being preceded by increases in oil prices.
Jeff Frankel used to be an economic advisor to Presidents Reagan and Clinton. He says correlation was more causation back in the 1970s. Turmoil in the Middle East led to soaring gas prices and shrinking disposable incomes. But Frankel says the U.S. energy infrastructure has changed a lot since then.
We used to be a net importer of oil. Now we are roughly in balance. We export oil and natural gas.
That means states like Texas will boom when energy prices are high, and the U.S. can ramp up production domestically to tide things over for a while. And though it seems counterintuitive, the pandemic has made American consumers less vulnerable to a major energy shock, says Eric Friedman at U.S. Bank Wealth Management.
One of the things that is a positive coming out of the pandemic is some level of savings that people had been able to store up.
U.S. households have more than $2 trillion in pandemic savings they can use to weather $4 or $5 a gallon. Credit that to unspent stimulus checks, postponed vacations, and other delayed purchases. Plus, a huge chunk of the workforce is still remote or in some hybrid arrangement. Again, Eric Friedman.
There certainly is a cohort that will not be as susceptible to price increases at the pump.
Of course, many people can't work from home. Ian Shepherdson at Pantheon Macroeconomics says while the U.S. as a whole may fare okay through months of high oil prices,
for people on low incomes who don't have savings to dip into, there's going to be an unambiguous hit.
Especially when the cost of food, rent, and other necessities is climbing too. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Two quick points coming out of Matt's story, picking up on those last items. Rising energy prices are, in a very real way, a brake, that's B-R-A-K-E, brake, on economic growth in this country. That's item one. So two, and this is item two, are interest rate increases. Don't forget, the Fed meets next week. Wall Street on this Tuesday, kind of up, down, and all around. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know how you say large, non-fat latte, please, in Russian, but it doesn't much matter anymore because Starbucks said today it's shutting things down over there. Coca-Cola did the same thing. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on the Corporations with a Conscience desk today.
Jeff Sonnenfeld and his team at the Yale School of Management are keeping a list of companies that have changed their operations in Russia, and it's being updated around the clock. A couple of hours after we spoke, McDonald's announced it's temporarily closing its 850 locations in Russia.
There's a spectrum of approaches, some of them that have been quite noteworthy and massive.
Like BP and Shell pulling billions of dollars in operations.
On the other extreme of the spectrum, you do have places saying, well, we're going to put on hold our future investments.
Like Yum Brands, which is putting new projects on hold, but keeping over 1,000 KFC and Pizza Hut locations open. And Sonnenfeld says this is where business models come into play. Because unlike McDonald's, which operates its own locations in Russia, Yum Brands operates under a franchise model.
So they can control the way the product is advertised and quality standards, but they don't have control over whether or not they're in business, because that's what they have, in fact, have sold.
It's one of many complexities companies are thinking about right now. Perhaps the biggest one is how long will this war last? N.O. Siemson, a professor of operations management at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says if the conflict is short and companies want to reopen their operations,
all the investments you've made over years are basically gone. If you want to re-enter the Russian market, you're starting more or less from scratch.
It might be a reason why McDonald's says it will continue paying workers while stores are closed, because shutting down isn't just about pulling money out of Russia. It's about psychological power.
So if people in Russia right now can't go to the mall and buy the latest smartphones anymore, they will very actively feel that they're not part of the global community anymore due to what has happened.
Which is the point, but it may also make Russians sour on those brands for a very long time. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Logistics are important in war, as the Russians are discovering, bogged down in many places as they are. Logistics are important for the rest of us, too, the supply chain that keeps the global economy going. And there are a whole lot of ways what's happening in Ukraine is throwing a wrench in those works. Ryan Peterson is the founder and the CEO of the global logistics platform Flexport, which is, of necessity, adapting to this new normal. It's also organizing, I should say, an airlift of supplies to refugee centers in Eastern Europe. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So from where you sit, looking at global shipping and cargo, what do you see in the last like 2 weeks?
Well, it's yet more volatility and chaos is probably the best way to describe it. Starting with the aviation sector, where you lose the ability to fly over Russia. And that's just for all the existing planes that can continue to fly. But Russian airplanes, Russian aviation has been more or less banned from most of the world's airports. And Ukraine was actually a major player in the air cargo industry. And those planes have all been completely removed effectively from the market as well. So the aviation air cargo business is dramatically cut short right now in capacity.
What about surface-borne sea transport and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, on the rail side, the Trans-Siberian Rail is actually a pretty important link between Asia, between China and Europe. And most companies, I think, are curtailing that. I haven't seen announcements from everybody. I know Flexport, we shut down our Trans-Siberian Rail service, mostly out of fear that the cargo would not arrive on the other side. And then on the ocean side, it's not a huge disruption for container shipping. Most of Russian exports are bulk, liquid, sort of energy commodities, those types of things that are not containerized. But the Black Sea shipping for those commodities is very much curtailed right now because of security risk. It's dangerous to ship into a war zone. You've had a couple of ships get attacked, and therefore all the insurance policies are canceled.
All right. So look, nobody listening to this interview needs to be told that the supply chain has been a mess for a while now. As we look to the next, I mean, who knows how long this is going to last, right? But for the next 6 to 8 months, what do you think? Just going to get more and more stressed?
Yeah, I think it's pretty ugly. You know, first off, energy prices are through the roof, and Russian energy is vital to the world's economy, and that's been more or less removed, and it's going to really cripple and increase the price of shipping anything anywhere. The thing I'm really worried about is food. Russia and Ukraine combined export like 30% of the world's wheat and grain. And if you're a food importing nation, watch out. I think it's going to be really chaotic times in a lot of countries that depend on those, on that grain.
Is there a way that, I don't even know how to ask this question, but is there a way that if there is some kind of agreement in Ukraine, things can stabilize reasonably quickly? Because as we know, the disruptions have been real and substantial, and we're still dealing with all of it.
Yeah. You know, the big one-way door is, are they able to plant the grain crop in Ukraine? And if they can't plant that crop, it's, you know, you're not getting that back for this season, and you're going to have a lot of fallout from that. As far as logistics, like, our industry will survive. We're kind of built for this. Like, it's been a lot of volatility and chaos for the last decade or so in global shipping. New ships are getting made all the time, and new airplanes will come online to backfill those that have been removed. Even the Russian planes are likely, you know, if I had to predict, they're likely to get sold to a company in another country that will keep operating them. So that capacity will return to the market over time. But the food is the one-way door. If you don't plant the grain crop, you're not going to export the grain.
What do you hear from the people you talk to in Ukraine and in some of the places that are most stressed?
Well, we're doing a lot of work right now with UNICEF and other aid agencies delivering products to refugees, to people who are affected by this humanitarian crisis. One thing that happens is they're almost overwhelmed right now with too much stuff being shipped in the short term and not always the right stuff. So I think it's important to, if you are interested in contributing here, probably money is more valuable than products at this moment in time. And for those who are involved in humanitarian relief, to sustain it, not just for the next 2 weeks or next month, but for the next 6 months and next 3 years, because I don't think this problem goes away overnight.
Yeah. Ryan Peterson, the founder, also the CEO of Flexport. Ryan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
The United Nations says that as of today, more than 2 million refugees have left Ukraine since the Russian invasion less than 2 weeks ago. For the people who are still there, life has become increasingly dangerous and difficult. And as their stories spread, people outside Ukraine are looking for ways to help, which for the less principled is an opportunity for fraud and scam. How then to get your donations into the right hands? Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that one.
Just about everywhere you look on social media right now, there are posts about ways to help Ukrainians. Kevin Scally at Charity Navigator says the easiest way to make sure your money is going to people who need it is by donating to registered nonprofits.
There's a lot of accountability there. Look for an organization that has a clear, articulated strategy for how they're actually responding to the crisis.
Big established organizations are the easiest to vet through websites that evaluate charities like Charity Navigator, the Better Business Bureau, and Global Giving.
There will be some legitimate organizations that pop up, but those pop-ups also create the possibilities for pop-ups who are not legitimate.
Patrick Rooney is at Indiana University's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy.
If it's somebody you know or somebody that you know who knows somebody that you know, that's one thing, but you get very many, you know, degrees removed from that, and I would just be very cautious.
If you see an appeal for donations from a group on social media, Sheena Ashley at the Urban Institute says don't just click the link and donate.
Give through their website to just be safe.
And always pay by credit card or check.
The charity should have multiple ways to accept a donation if it's legitimate. It's not just cash, gift card, or wire transfer. Those are things that should raise your alarm.
GoFundMe is currently vetting all Ukraine-related fundraisers on its site, says the company's president, Juan Benitez.
So if you see a fundraiser on our platform to benefit Ukraine, you can trust that it's legitimate.
So far, Benitez says, hundreds of thousands of people have donated more than $20 million and counting just in the last couple of weeks. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's creating it's a puzzle piece.
Trying to fit it all together, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 184 today, about a 0.5%, 32,632. The NASDAQ off 35 points, 0.25%, 12,795. S&P 500 down 30 points, about 0.7%, 41.70 there. Shell gained 2.4% today. The oil giant apologized for buying a discounted consignment of Russian oil and said it would make no more spot purchases of Russian crude. Alternative energy companies are feeling the love. Solar powerhouse Enphase Energy warmed up 10.8% today. Solar panel and battery maker SunPower surged 18.75%. Apple faded 1.1%. The company held its first launch event of the year today and announced, among other things, oh, look, a new iPhone and a new iPad. What a surprise. Bond prices down, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.83%. I've got both of those things. Don't yell at me. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The list of things, by which I mostly mean commodities, that are all of a sudden in short supply because of the war, we have talked about quite a bit the past couple of weeks. Wheat and sunflower oil and nickel. Also today, a new one. Neon. Yes, neon as in neon signs, but more strategically, in today's economy, neon as in essential to semiconductor manufacturing. Russia and Ukraine together produce a whole lot of neon. And all that gas suddenly becoming unavailable? Well, that is definitely not what the already stressed chip industry needs. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
Those bright glowing signs that say eat at Nick's or open or Yingling, they consume a tiny fraction of the world's neon.
Neon signs are 1-2% of the world's production. I mean, or demand. It's very small.
Richard Betzendahl is in the neon business, you might say. He runs a consulting firm that does market research on gases. He says most of the world's neon is used in a light source of a different kind, lasers.
Excimer lasers, which is the high-powered laser that can drill holes through metal and so forth. It needs neon.
Those lasers are critical to the process of manufacturing semiconductor chips. They etch circuit patterns onto wafers of silicon. Nina Turner is an analyst with IDC.
It's creating a... It's a puzzle piece. You're taking these different patterns and putting them down on the wafer.
Turner says that process is used to manufacture 90% of the chips made today, including those used in cars, memory, and power management, all areas where there are already chip shortages. And with a neon shortage on the way,
I think companies are downplaying their worry, but I do think that they are putting contingency plans into place, right, you know, as we speak.
Turner says most companies have a couple months worth of neon on hand. And the Semiconductor Industry Association, a trade group for American chip makers, says the industry has a diverse set of suppliers. That's partly because it's been in this position before. The last time Russia invaded Ukraine 8 years ago, neon prices shot up. Here's industry consultant Richard Betzenball again.
That was a bad time. And what happened back then was then China, they then put in a lot of neon capacity.
Even with Chinese plants capturing and exporting neon, Russia and Ukraine remain critical to the supply chain. Cryoin Engineering is located in southern Ukraine in the port city of Odessa. It exports neon to customers around the world, including in the U.S. Larissa Bondarenko is the business development director there. She says Cryoin has stopped production and shipments are already delayed. She's concerned bombing will damage the company's plant or key transportation infrastructure.
There's a high risk that ports will be destroyed, then the logistics will be much, much harder to restart.
She's also worried about Cryoin's workforce. Bondarenko says 80% of the company's employees are men who are now required to defend the country. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Chinese President Xi Jinping doesn't think much of Western sanctions on Moscow. On a conference call today with Macron of France and Scholz of Germany, she said the sanctions are a blow to the stability of global finance, energy, and transportation and supply chains, which perhaps helps explain why China continues to trade with Russia, as does the possibility that Beijing might just be able to get itself some deals, huh? Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has that one.
Music on the street selling mostly Russian products in China's northeastern Heilongjiang. The province shares a part of its border with Russia. Most of the shops here in Harbin City sell identical Russian biscuits, vodka, and chocolates with a chubby baby on the packaging. Some of those items have recently been flying off the virtual shelves of an online vendor that claims to be backed by the Russian embassy in China. Sergei Batsev of the Russian Chamber of Commerce in China taped a video message for Chinese consumers.
Dear Chinese friends, thank you for supporting Russia and the shop during this difficult time.
The difficult time he's referring to means the Western sanctions Russia is facing for its war in Ukraine. Now, the law of supply and demand says if fewer countries want to do business with Russia, supply goes up. And since China is Russia's biggest trade partner, it could negotiate cheaper prices for Russian exports, like oil and gas. It's possible, but not likely, says Xiong Peng, a global commodities trader in Beijing.
The reasoning is that the price of commodities like natural gas is decided over a long period with complex calculation. You can't just use today's price to decide the price for the next 20 years.
Also, he says the buyers of Russian oil and gas are mainly Chinese government firms, and they don't always make deals based on profits. And as for trade the other way, selling to Russia, things aren't going well there for Chinese exporters either. Russia's currency, the ruble, has fallen by a lot against the U.S. dollar, which, as the e-commerce news site EN News lays out, is a problem.
The depreciation of the Russian ruble will impact Chinese and foreign companies, because China-Russia trade is mainly settled in U.S. dollars. Even if Chinese suppliers don't increase the price, Russian buyers still need to pay more rubles to buy the same products. So Russian clients won't place as many orders.
And some Chinese suppliers fear their Russian clients can't pay with the sanctions in place. Chinese officials say they are neutral on the war, but China has chosen Russia's side, which isn't a problem for now, says commodities trader Xiong Peng.
As long as China does not change its current stance and officials continue to say ambiguous comments that don't amount to much, China won't be directly sanctioned.
Even if China wanted to show support to Russia and buy more oil and gas, it's not that easy. Because there isn't enough infrastructure to support this, he says.
China can't find enough oil tankers to ship Russian oil. Many shipping companies are afraid of being sanctioned for shipping Russian oil. And as for natural gas, the pipeline from Russia is behind schedule. It has only reached China's northeast to Harbin City.
The war in Ukraine has consequences beyond that country and Russia. Take logistics, which are already under pressure worldwide from the COVID-19 pandemic. Here's a video by e-commerce consultant Mangler Technology.
For air transportation, bypassing Russian airspace means it takes longer to ship products. The war has also pushed up the price of oil, the biggest cost for airlines, and transportation prices.
So shipping stuff out takes longer and costs more, which may be why that online Russian shop, thankful as it is for Chinese consumer support, also issued a plea. Again, Batsev of the Russian Chamber of Commerce in China.
I ask you for your patience and understanding. It will take longer for you to receive the orders.
Please, he tells Chinese consumers, avoid unnecessary orders. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, news from the good people at Quinnipiac, the pollsters. It is Quinnipiac, by the way, not the other way you sometimes hear it. I emailed them, asked them, Quinnipiac. Anyway, Americans, 71% to 22%, say they support a ban on Russian oil, even if it means higher gas prices here. And that is across party lines, Dems, 82 to 12, Independents, 70 to 22, and Republicans, 66 to 30. I'm just going to leave that there because, honestly, I find that kind of heartening. All right, we're out of here, but here is your moment of economic context. Commodities, once again, because that is kind of the name of the macroeconomic game right now. We talked about nickel yesterday. Prices going up so fast, the London Metal Exchange has had to stop trading altogether in that major industrial metal. But what about the nickel? Well, as of today, the amount of nickel in a nickel is worth 4.7 cents. The amount of copper in a nickel is worth 3.9 cents. Y'all can do the math, right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.